Okay, we're going to go ahead and call the meeting to order. We do not yet have a quorum, so we are not able to take any action at this time on our official business, but being that we have testifiers and presentations today, we will be able to go ahead and gather that information, and it looks like members are coming in here. We now have a quorum. I'm going to officially call the meeting to order. Thank you very much. And so I have reversed the order today in regards to the agenda, so I just wanted to let you know ahead of time that we are going to be taking the emergency physicians group presentation first. Dr. Hegard is actually working, and so out of respect for him and the time he's taken off from work, if we can get him here a little bit earlier, gets him back to doing an important job. I would also like to take action on, since we have a quorum and we can do the minutes for today, is there Representative Lohmer?
I'd be happy to do that. Move the minutes.
Making the motion to approve the minutes?
I am making that motion.
All right. That has been made. Any changes, additions, corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Minutes are adopted. Thank you very much, Representative Lohmer. All right. Very much welcome to you, Dr. Hegard, today. You're representing the Emergency Physicians Group. And is this a Minnesota or American College National Group? Are you speaking on behalf of? And if you would just say your name for the record and any of that other kind of information is helpful, too.
Happy
welcome.
Happy to do that. And I want to thank Madam Chair, all the members of this important, distinguished committee, and I appreciate the time to do this. I have about a five-minute comments that I'll make, and then I really want to give time for you to ask questions. I am representing a couple different areas here. First, I'm a faculty physician at Hennepin County Medical Center. I've been there since 1994. I did my residency from 91 to 94 there, so I've been a longtime member of Hennepin County Medical Center. I'm also the incoming president of the Minnesota chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians. I'm a medical director for LifeLink 3 and for Hennepin County Medical Center, so I do both ground and air. And then I'm also was the founding emergency physician on the State Trauma Advisory Committee. And probably most importantly to you, I was the lead physician when the bridge collapsed at Hennepin County. So what I want to do is just emphasize, as I know all of you have so much important work to do before you and some tough, tough choices, but I want to emphasize the critical role of a Level 1 trauma center specifically, and the role and the interplay of EMS in that. And I'm going to touch upon a little bit on MRCC, which is our medical communication system, which I want to make sure you know something, more knowledge on that, and also that you have a resource if you have more questions. So, a couple of things. I think that we demonstrated pretty clearly the key role of a Level 1 trauma center when the bridge collapsed. But more importantly, I just was working yesterday. I'm working today. We had took care of a person from just north of Zimmerman the other night. Had a kind of a routine. Looked like they had a pelvic fracture. They couldn't get some things done at an outside hospital. They transferred in because they had a fracture dislocation. We found out this was a bleeding hematoma. Within an hour, things were fixed. It was routine. We do this every day, and it's not just Hennepin, North Memorial, Regions, Mayo. There is a special expertise that a Level 1 trauma center has that has been developed. Hennepin happens to be the oldest, 25 years in 2009. But all of us have a special expertise, and it's crucial to the safety and welfare of the citizens of Minnesota. Then we do the more dramatic, which is the bridge collapse. And I fully understand you have expectations of us, and that expectation should be we perform like we did on the 35W bridge collapse, which I'm not going to go through that. And I was asked if there was a PowerPoint. I'm happy at some point to give a talk on that, which I've done locally and nationally and internationally at times, and people had a lot of interest. But the bottom line is, We got everybody out through a very sophisticated EMS system in 1 hour and 26 minutes, fastest of any disaster of its sort. We had Hennepin. We had we were full within an hour. We had opened up 25 ICUs. We managed 26 people. We went to the operating room that night 6 times. We opened up 3 operating rooms in less than 20 minutes, 4 CT scanners, and completely opened up our emergency department to 80 potential beds. Now, none of us, you have tough choices in front of you, but you need that capacity when bad things happen. And it is a complex and somewhat expensive system, but we've done everything we can, I think, to try to reduce that. And I want to emphasize the fragility of it. The other thing I want to emphasize to you, when we publish this data and we put it on the STACK website, there is good, well-referenced, outstanding research to tell us that level one trauma centers have better outcomes than any other trauma centers when you're talking about severely injured patients. And that's at the extreme of ages, both at the young and the old. And parenthetically, I seem to be getting more interested in the management of elderly issues for me. So I'm getting approaching 50 in a year. So I think we really do need to emphasize that important role. Last thing I want to really emphasize, the important synergy between EMS and level one trauma centers and MRCC. The bridge could never have been managed so well, and our EMS system, our trauma system, could never occur without a kind of robust EMS system. We have, by far, the best EMS system in the nation. And I will go anywhere, ask anyone. It was developed very carefully, very methodically, and I am worried, to be quite honest, about the potential effects on level one trauma centers and the EMS system if it's not done carefully. We have a fragile system. The economics are, and I'll be blunt, the no-fault repeal would be devastating to the trauma system. And in the end, you will have an unstable trauma system where the state or local government, but it will be both, will have to rebuild it, will be more expensive, and actually produce worse outcomes. So I just ask you to be very careful on that, and I'm willing to share any data. We have lots of information on this. All you have to do is look at Chicago in the 1990s when they destabilized their level one trauma system, and it they're still trying to get out of that mess. So an MRCC, which is really the nerve center of the EMS system, they coordinate all our disaster, all of our calls. If we didn't have MRCC on the bridge, you would have seen a complete confusion. Instead, you saw great interplay between police, fire, EMS, the hospitals, all the hospitals, because we have one of the best tracking systems, and we've had it for 10 years in Minnesota. All of them were alerted. We knew what the capacity of the U, North Memorial, regions, if we needed more. Because in the beginning, those early hour, early minutes, when I was trying to decide to call out a orange disaster, I had no idea if this was a bombing, a terrorist act, or unbelievably, the bridge fell down, something we never planned for, ever. We planned about the dome, not the roof collapsing, but the dome. We planned a lot of things, but we did not plan a bridge going down. So I appreciate your patience hearing this. I want to answer any questions you have, and I want to be respectful of your time. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Hegard. Just really appreciate your service. I know on behalf of the committee that we would all appreciate it very much. By the way, at the age of 50, I think Representative Huntley, we would call that a young pup. Yeah, perspective.
Well, I promise you, we're focused on the, and the outcome is on the other extremes of age. Yes, a little higher. But
thank you, Dr. Hegard. My husband served in Cochi as head nurse on the emergency room with direct battlefield casualties in Vietnam. So trauma is its own unique special field, take its own kind of practitioners, those who can live on adrenaline at a sustained level, and we need such folks as you as well. Are there other questions here from members of the committee? Representative Liebling?
Well, thank you very much. Thank you, Dr. Hegarth, for being here today. And I think what you've said is incredibly important to us. And, you know, this is a finance committee, as you know. And so I wonder if you could be a little bit more specific. I mean, I hear you here telling us how important it is to support the Level 1 trauma centers.
Mm-hmm.
One thing you might address just quickly, I'm not sure if everybody understands the different levels, because some and why Level 1. You said Level 1 centers are particularly well equipped to handle certain kinds of things, but also I think it would be very helpful to us, as you're saying to us, you know, how important it is to keep this system intact, if you would tell us which funding streams support you that we should be particularly careful about.
So let me address the first question, which I appreciate you asking, because I didn't want to cover things that you may have already know and or be in, or I'd be redundant. But Level 1 is the highest trauma designation that any hospital who wants to be a trauma hospital can attain. In the state of Minnesota, that's actually done through the American College of Surgeons. There is a two-day site visit, which I have participated in multiple times. The key on that is that it's an interdisciplinary approach to management of trauma. And the key on a Level 1 trauma center is, one, you have every specialty in-house, and you have a trauma surgeon that is in-house and immediately available within 15 minutes. You have board-certified emergency physicians. You have the highest level and access to neurosurgeons. And I think just intuitively you can know that that's not that's an expensive prospect to have that around available all the time. And so that's your highest. And the reason the outcomes are better on that is, one, the resources there, the people there, but also the coordination of research. Let me give you an example. Somebody comes in, they have a pelvic fracture. They're bleeding. Now, we've known that one of our highest levels of mortality have been pelvic fractures. So if you're at a Level 1 trauma center, if you're not, and I've practiced in outer places, what you're going to do is you're going to try to stabilize that. You're going to try to put some pressure on it. You're going to try to get them in. The old days, meaning 2 years ago, 3 years ago, we would have operated on that. What we do now is we immediately get them in at Hennepin. I'm sure regions in North have this. We have a particular suite. So an operating suite, but it's done radiologically. We can get them in and stop that bleeding through coiling within 20 minutes if they hit our door, because we activate it. Those are resources and techniques and skills that only a few places can have because they're extremely expensive. Level 2 is the next setting, which what they have is a designation. Again, that's designated by the American College of Surgeons. Very high level of care. They don't have the immediate availability all the time. They don't have the research that's supporting it, and they don't have to always require a neurosurgeon and full coordinated care. And there's been studies to show their Level 2s are very important, but there's a difference in outcome between. And Level 3 is a hospital that has taken the commitment to do emergency and trauma care. They will admit anything that's not life-threatening if they have a surgeon who is available to come in, evaluate, and admit, and work with a primary care or a family physician to admit. And then Level 4 is basically will only clear non-admission trauma. Everything else will be sent in. So there's a very clear designation. Now, money, you had asked about the revenue streams, which is important. Well, you know, there's good data to tell us, and I know we can get it to you, and we've probably shared it with you. Level 1 trauma centers always have a higher proportion of uninsured and underinsured. It's the name of the game. And you balance that, quite honestly, with some paying patients. And then one of the important revenue streams, to be straightforward, is this auto null fall. Now, I understand why the argument to repeal that is. But I think the flip side of that is that the auto no fault is providing a significant income stream that is offsetting the cost of running a complex Level 1 trauma center. So that's the main source of income. Everything else, you know, it doesn't matter if we're at Hennepin or at North or Regions or Mayo has a less because they have a much smaller Medicaid population, less uninsured. But you're doing it by trying to figure out your revenue sources other ways. And trauma alone, if you're talking about blunt trauma, has a small margin. You know, penetrating trauma, absolutely. You're lost the minute they hit the door. And it's a complex financing of that. So, you know, North, Hennepin really take a lot of penetrating trauma. It's complex, and it's usually related to some not such good behavior. So, does
thank
that
you,
help
Doc.
At all? I can be more specific.
Thank you, Dr. Hegard. I'll give Representative Liebling an opportunity to do a follow-up question so that if that's not quite sufficient or specific enough for her, she can follow up with another question. And did you have?
Well, yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you very much. And that's very helpful. I mean, it's, you know, sometimes we need to sort of take life and make it fit our budget so that we see how the two things fit together, and it's not always easy to know that, to understand that, because our budget process is complicated and, you know, the budget doesn't work like life works. So I know that I think the no-fault thing is very important to know, to understand that, but then the other part of that is just, you know, are you saying, you know, it's mainly the general way we fund hospitals, and, you know, obviously if the hospital's collapsing economically, it's going to have a hard time supporting its level one trauma centers. Is that kind of what I'm understanding here, or is there more specific?
Dr. Hegard?
Sorry.
That's okay. You can proceed. Usually the process, I didn't want to necessarily interrupt you, but we usually go through the chair, and it's just a matter of recognizing you before you speak. It also helps on a tape recording that they are more confident of who is speaking on the tape at that time.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll try to hold.
I hope I didn't interrupt your train of thought.
Not at all.
Please go ahead.
In regard to that, I think the key thing to know is that if your financing changes significantly for a very marginal profit line of service. So I'm going to stick with Hennepin. Hennepin is committed to this. They're so is North, the other ones. But what happens is you have to be able to have some form of margin to be able to grow all the important things of any hospital, which is usually your facility and your costs and keeping up with technology and campus. So it destabilizes the ability to either subsidize it, which is in the case of Hennepin because of our payer mix, or being able to really improve to the point where you're providing it. And what happens is then you have a site visit and you're not providing the care. That starts destabilizing. What happened in Chicago is a number of the level one trauma centers closed because it just wasn't economically viable. There's no confusion. This is a tough economic time. Hennepin, I can tell you, we survived CCDS, and I know that's complicated, but sure wasn't an easy ride. And then you start taking away some areas that you can count on some flow of financing to manage these patients. And so I think that's it. And then you start doing it with the EMS system, and I understand you got tough decisions, but then you start destabilizing a system that in the end, in 5-10 years, will be saying, well, we didn't want to do that. And the cost is going to be more. And the question is, if you look at it, can you regain that once you start destabilizing? Quick answer is, level twos will become level ones. Well, it's not that easy because they're looking at it going, ooh, I'm not quite sure I like that payer mix. I'm not sure I like the outcome of that. I'm not sure I'm going to go into that. And it's an interesting finance question, actually. And then the issue is patient care. And patient care, you don't want to have these wars where we're trying to shunt paying patients and non-paying patients to only other places. Because the patient never wins in that, which is my issue.
Thank you, Dr. Hegard. Representative Liebling?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you very much. Representative Murphy, were you waiting for a question? We weren't quite sure, but you are.
I am, Madam Chair.
Good,
thank you.
Good.
Dr. Hegard, your information and explanation in response to Representative Liebling's questions are helpful. And and some of your answer touched on my question, but I've heard some chatter that there is an interest in eliminating the designation, the trauma designation system in Minnesota. So I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about what would happen if we just decided not to have hospitals designated as level 1, 2, or 3. And there are surgeons that are living in different parts of the state and practicing in different parts of the state, so couldn't, if we got rid of that, would the facilities in place be able to just pick up the slack?
Dr. Hegard.
Thank you. I'm biased. I sat on the State Trauma Advisory Committee for 8 years of my life, and it was actually, but I am insightful. It's, you know, we've created a better system, I think. But we have some burdens on the hospital. You know, this wasn't free. And there's actually burdens of saying some tough things. You know, the surgeon has to be within 15 or 30 minutes, has to come in, or they have to transfer the patient if it's a life-threatening injury. But if they're thinking of keeping them there, they have to come in. That's a real cost to hospital. I think it's part of doing the business, but it's real. We have some administrative cost. What do I think would overall, and I have to admit it's a tricky question for me because I understand the referral center's dilemma and the outside hospitals, but I am worried because I think every bit of literature and data tells us that the outcomes are improved in patients when you have a mature, established trauma system. We're one of only three states, and Tim Held and others can correct me if I'm wrong on that, but I think it's three states that doesn't have a mature trauma system. So excluding the cost, I think we'd be making a mistake. And the cost, as I understand it, and I won't go into that, but it's relatively modest for what we've developed, excluding the real concerns of some outside hospital about what's going on. And I think you should listen to that. I think you should hear it. But my own personal standpoint from the patient care, and let me give you an example. One of the best things I think the trauma system did is we used to sometimes transfer a patient, you know, if they got hurt in Roseau, they might go down to one hospital, let's say undesignated, be evaluated, then be transferred to, let's just, for example, to St. Cloud. And St. Cloud, great place, great hospital, outstanding care, but they don't have a CV surgeon who can repair a dissected aorta. They'd come to Hennepin or North or Regions. And then they're repaired. What we've done, one example of that, is we've eliminated those four steps. We've made them into two or one directly, and very carefully not to overfly or avoid other hospitals, because that's an important thing. But we've made it into two steps. There's only one win in that. That's for patient care, and you've reduced costs. So I think that's a pretty powerful argument for it. And I'm supportive of the trauma system, but understand the concerns outside hospitals have.
Thank you, Dr. Hegard. One question I have for you on that line as well is, do you find, though, also that the communications work, you know, when you have those level 1, 2, 3, 4, and you have those definitions, everybody can be on the same page and understand what that means and more clearly communicate, it would seem. If you didn't do that, you'd kind of have to maybe know by name or what does that mean. Seems like these designations, which was the question I heard from Representative Murphy, they really help to clarify communications in a very critical time.
Absolutely. I think when we developed our system, it was very effective, and it's grown and matured to the point we're at a size where we need designation so people understand, okay, this is what this hospital can and cannot do. I'm talking about the EMS providers, where you can have things like MRCC and other communications, but understand what the capabilities of every hospital is. If not, it's kind of left up to the goodwill, which we all have, but sometimes we get confused and not sure exactly what we can do. And it depends. If you're, you know, if a general surgeon is managing something and they're covering three hospitals, you know, then that person arrives there and you can't have access to it, and it delays care. And one thing we know, heart attacks, strokes, trauma, we can extend to other things. Time is absolutely essential to definitive care. And so I would echo and I agree with you that I think it clarifies and improves patient care.
Thank you, Dr. Hegard. One other thing, is there a Southern Minnesota hospital that's also a level 1?
Oh, yeah, I said Mayo.
Yes, thank you, Dr.
Absolutely.
Hegarth.
Absolutely. Mayo is a great, outstanding one.
I noticed, Dr. Hegarth, that it was on the list, and I know that was absolutely no oversight of yours, but I just wanted to be sure we gave one of our premier folks, as they all are, but some recognition in the midst. And Representative Murphy, was there any other question? All right. Thank you very much. Representative Slawick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Hegarth, I just have a quick question, which I'm not sure if you're going to be able to answer. You know, when you talk about trauma level one hospitals, and then it's a question about regions, and then I live in the East Metro, and regions I drive by every day, and lately they are running this ad about emergency room waiting times, and come to regions to, because it has the least time to wait for an emergency room visit. And when I think of a level one trauma hospital, if someone's having a heart attack, they want them to think about regions. I mean, it seems odd to me that they would be doing that, because I think of all the people we hear about in this committee that are walking into emergency rooms that really shouldn't be there. They should be doing their preventative care and going somewhere else. So if do you have any insight into that? I just, every time I hear it, I think, why are they doing this? And we've also toured regions and learned about it.
Dr. Hegarth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, I do want to be really careful. I know I said Mayo and then my first introduction.
Good.
Yes.
Good.
Great trauma center, great place.
Well, better to be sure.
The only difference is they have a lower Medicaid and a lower uninsured, but they still deal with all the things we have, and they have a phenomenal system. So, that said, do I want to answer that question? No. But I'll give you an answer, and an honest answer on this. You know, that... I don't want to weigh too much in this, but it's an interesting thing. Representative Murphy has heard my opinions at times on this thing as well. There is no doubt. There's 10 to 15%, and this is national data that we can get from ASAP, that show that, you know, their care could probably be in a different setting than an emergency department. I think that's what you're really shooting for when you're trying to get primary care. You've got years and years and years and years of developing primary care more. But secondly, then there's a whole area, which is emergency care is one that, if we're using the prudent layperson's definition, is how do you define a emergency? And I would challenge you, I've been doing this for, you know, close to 20 years, when you come in and you've got chest pain, and I pick up your thoracic dissection that's about to kill you, instead of me, and I do an EKG and I show you're not having a heart attack, but I pick this up because your story is very subtle. I get an x-ray and I say, well, that's kind of wide. I check your blood pressures on both sides and it's off, and I say, you know, this time I actually have to do a CT scan on you, and I get your diagnosis correct. We have not been able to figure out yet a computer system, a person who's been able to differentiate that. So your answer to advertising, you know, I think here's the good patient answer on that. We are all of us are aware that people get frustrated waiting in emergency departments, and we're trying to improve that and actually improve their satisfaction. Is there advertisement in that element? Absolutely. And I'm not going to go into that because they're a great center and they've decided to go that. But that's, you know, they're trying to make people aware that their visit time is shorter, which is a patient-centered expectation, which is appropriate. The issue, my own personal feeling, and I'd be happy to talk more, is emergency departments are kind of getting a bad rap. We've been thrown with EMTALA, which is what's required. We've been the open access. So without emergency department care, this healthcare system would have been a real mess. And we want to be part of changing it. We want to improve patient care, and we also have to be there. That you can't get it at a minute clinic. You're not looking at a minute clinic when you are having your MI. So,
thank you, Dr. Hegarth. Anything else, Representative Slawick?
Thank you.
All right, very good. Well, Dr. Hegarth, is anybody else with you today who would like to also testify in regards to the subject of emergency physicians?
I think I'm a solo today.
Well, that's very good. Well, we appreciate your taking the time to come and present to us and give valuable information. We certainly do appreciate that very much. And again, be sure you sign the testifier's spreadsheet there to make sure we have that information correct for you. And thank you very much for coming.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and all the representatives for having me. Appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. We'll then proceed to the next item on our agenda, Minnesota Department of Health making their economics program presentation. That seems like an unusual thing, Department of Health with economics, but looking forward to that. Dr. Golden, when you're ready, please introduce yourself for the record and anybody testifying with you as well. It looks like your presentation is ready to go. So welcome to the committee, and please proceed.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Jim Golden. I am the Director of the Division of Health Policy at the Minnesota Department of Health. And I have with me today April Todd Malmlov, who is the State Health Economist with the Health Economic Program. First, I'd just like to thank the committee for finding time in its busy schedule to provide us the opportunity to give you an overview of what we do with the Health Economics Program. I think Minnesota's Health Economics Program is a tremendous resource that many states wish that they had. It is a program that has been developed over 20 years in a very bipartisan way by both Democrats and Republicans, and has supported both Republican and independent, and now a Democratic governor as well. And so what we are going to talk about today is just give you a little bit of a history to understand how it is, as you pointed out, Madam Chair, that it is in the health department, a little bit about what we actually do with health policy, the type of research, some of the data that we collect, and how that might be helpful to you as you consider some of the challenging issues that are facing you. And then Ms. Todd Malmlov is going to walk through samples of some of the information that we have that are probably relevant to some of the types of issues that you are facing. The history of the health economics program really starts in the late 80s when we were focused on hospitals and trying to understand kind of what was going on in the hospitals, what were some of the financials associated with that, some of the utilization. Shortly thereafter, it became, we also added the state health economist to recognize the growing importance of health and healthcare in the U.S. economy and the Minnesota economy, and to make sure that we really did have a focus on those types of issues and understanding how that played out, the relationship between health in the business of healthcare. In the early 90s, much of our work expanded to really provide unbiased analysis of the healthcare market. And much of this focused on the payer market. So we started to look more at some of the insurance that was there. How was that impacting what was going on in our economy? What were we paying for? Where was the money going? Where is it coming from? As many of you certainly are aware, one of the goals that Minnesota has had for a long time is to get to universal coverage, to try to ensure that all people have access to health care. And the Health Economics Program really became the definitive source for information about the uninsured, how many people are uninsured, what are their characteristics, and how do those differ from people who have insurance. One of the things that the Health Economics Program has also done is staffed a variety of task forces over the years. So certainly Governor Ventura had the Joint Task Force, which was looking at how do we get healthcare costs under control. Governor Pawlenty had the Transformation Task Force. I believe Representative Huntley was one of the co-chairs of that. Again, that was looking at how do we deliver better care and get cost containment in the system. The Health Economics Program really provided the staffing and expertise to help support the policymakers in coming forward with their recommendations. And some of our most recent activity has come out of the 2008 health reform, where it's looking at how do we start to ensure that we are purchasing health care for value. How do we make sure that we're getting the highest quality at the most affordable cost that we possibly can within our healthcare system? So what is it that we do? Essentially, we do applied policy analysis and research. And I know in these tough economic times, the idea that someone sitting over at a state agency doing research is probably a little disconcerting. But this isn't about research that we want to see published in a scientific journal. This is about research and getting information to people exactly like yourself, to legislators, to the governor's office, to outside interest groups that are worried about these issues. And our happiest day is when you are debating some issue in this committee and you have people of opposing sides, and they are both using our data to help to make their points. I think that is when we are by far the happiest, and is even better than getting any publications that we might have. The other thing that we do is we certainly work with policymakers, both in the development and analysis of policy, to talk about what we expect based on the science, how their policies or proposals might impact quality, affordability, or access to healthcare. Because you have invested in this resource for quite a long time, over 20 years, we have tremendous longitudinal data. We can show where we have been with regard to trends. We can help to explain where we see things that have changed over time. We do also conduct a variety of administrative reviews. We do a public interest review whenever there is an exception to the hospital moratorium. That is something that you'll see coming before this committee. We are charged with doing an antitrust analysis for rural health cooperatives. We also have some anti-kickback, antitrust administrative activities that we do as well. And finally, we have a prime responsibility in implementing the quality measurement and cost measurement that was passed in the bipartisan 2008 health reform. I thought it might be helpful. This is kind of a list, and hopefully the names of what's on this list will give you a sense of what it is. I'm not going to go into great detail, but I wanted to let you know some of the primary data sources that we collect. We collect a fair amount of data around cost and spending. From health plans, we can collect an annual financial and statistical report to make sure that we understand both the public and private sector. We collect data related to Medicare, the state public programs, and other public sources, including the state employee program. We collect a fair amount of data from hospitals. That data is such high quality that is used for the MA surcharge. One of the newest and most exciting things that we have is actually our encounter data. You might hear this in your travels as the all-payer claims data. This is really a detailed look. It's de-identified information, so it's not information that identifies any patient, but really shows for each encounter what has been going on in the healthcare system, who has been providing those services, and actually the dollars that are changing hands, both from the health plans as well as the enrollees. We look at people's health insurance coverage. We have a biennial health access survey that finds out about the uninsured. We get some information from the health plans as part of our statistical report. Again, we collect data from DHS and CMS around public programs. And we also work with insurance companies and health plans to make sure we understand what's going on in the small group and individual market. We also have information about utilization, what's going on in the delivery system. We get information from the hospitals through our healthcare cost information system. We collect information on diagnostic imaging, which has been an interest of this committee for some time, as well as from freestanding surgical centers. We get information on capital expenditures for any expenditure over $1 million. And again, our encounter data is quite helpful for this. And one of the newest areas that we have been moving into quality, we have our statewide quality reporting system that we do in collaboration with Minnesota Community Measurement. And again, we think that our encounter data is also a vehicle for looking at some of these issues. Well, that's a lot of data. And I think some of the questions are, what do we do with that data? What types of analyses, what types of reports are we putting together? What I'm going to go through here is just kind of a sense of, in general, what we're doing. And then Ms. Todd Malmlov is going to go through some very specific data as to what's going on in the market. You know, with regard to cost and spending, we annually publish information about what the total spending is, where it's going, where it's coming from. We also look at, for example, uncompensated care. What is some of the burden on our hospitals associated with that care? Administrative costs, particularly with the health plans. That has certainly been a topic that you have addressed over the years that we have tried to get as consistent as possible. And then what are really some of the cost drivers? So we know that healthcare costs are rising at an unsustainable rate. What's driving that? And where do we really need to focus our effort if we want to get healthcare costs under control? With regard to insurance coverage, just what's the distribution, where are people covered for their health care coverage, who's left out, what are the characteristics of those different groups. We had one, what's the access to care and the health status of the uninsured. What's been happening with benefits in the small group and individual market, as well as affordability. Certainly affordability is one of the key drivers in the insurance issue. You can see on some of our services and utilization, how do health conditions start to drive some of the utilization in hospitals? Where are the beds and where are they by specialty? So do all Minnesotans have access to the type of care that they're likely to need? What's going on with mental health and chemical dependency? Clearly that has been an issue that has been in front of this committee before, as well as what's going on with preventive services and how are those services being utilized by kids and children. With regard to quality, we have published now our first quality report from the 2008 reforms that went out in the fall. We are also working with both the public and private sector to think about how do you start to align pay-for-performance quality incentives so that all payers, both public and private, are sending a common market message, as well as what's going on with preventable hospitalizations. You will also see that on the final slide, we also study a number of issues that are of interest to you that you simply want a more intense look at. Some of the ones that we have done in the recent past have been looking at health plans and what, as nonprofits, they can contribute to the community benefit. We have taken a look at the nonprofit hospitals and kind of what some of their burden has been with uncompensated care, their contribution to community benefits, and the value of their tax exemptions as nonprofit. What's driving what is the arms war or the investment in medical facilities? Again, here you see an example of a public interest review that was done for the psychiatric hospital. It's now Prairie Care. And then also some of what's going on with Medicare and drug use. So I think, as you can see, there's quite a lot of topics. We have a fair amount of expertise in issues that have been of interest to both this committee and Representative Gottwalt's committee, and we would be more than happy to share any of these analyses or talk with you further if there's an opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Golden. Ms. Tallmonlove, are you going to continue then with your, and are we going to be on, we're just going to do continuing the PowerPoint for the members? Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes.
Please proceed. Thank you.
Yeah, so for the record, my name is April Tallmonlove. I'm the state health economist and the director of the health economics program. So as Dr. Golden was explaining, we're going to go through a few slides here that are just examples of some of the work that we do. It's not the full breadth of everything, but at least wanted to give you a sense of the type of data that we have. So first we'll start and talk a bit about healthcare spending in the state. So just to give a broad brush of where we sit in comparison to the federal government, in Minnesota, we spend roughly 13.4% or 13.4% of our economy goes towards health care. Compared to the U.S. is at 15.1%. And so we are lower than the U.S. and historically have been lower than the U.S. in terms of our health care spending. And the top part of that chart shows actual per capita spending in Minnesota compared to the U.S. And so per capita, we are at roughly $6,700 per capita, with the U.S. at roughly $7,200 per capita on spending. So where does that spending come from? Who is paying out the dollars? The biggest payer of those dollars is from the private health insurance market, so those with private health insurance coverage. Other large chunks include spending from medical assistance at 18.4%, spending from Medicare at 16.7%. There's also a large portion that is coming from out-of-pocket spending by consumers that is at 12.9%. So out of the money that gets spent, where does it go towards?
Excuse me, Ms. Tallmonlove, we could just have a moment.
Yes.
Representative Huntley?
Madam Chair and Ms. Tallmonlove, does this include long-term care?
Yes, it does include long-term care.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Huntley?
Yeah.
All right, thank you very much. Please continue.
And related, Madam Chair and Representative Huntley, related to your question, that is on the next slide related to where the spending does go to in the state. And so you will see that long-term care Long-term care represents 15% of spending. Next to that is hospital care at 32.6%, physician services at 21.5%, and other spending that's categorized as prescription drugs or dental services, other professional services, those types of components. And there's also an other spending category that is the 14.1%, and that includes a variety of things such as chemical dependency and mental health, durable medical goods, and this is also the component where you would see administrative costs or administrative spending would also be incorporated in this other component. And that has generally been running around 8% or so in Minnesota for the last few years. So the other thing that we do...
Mr. Momlove, I have a question for you. How do you know what people are spending out of pocket? How do you define out of pocket spending? It seems to me like, what makes it, because it's a quite large number. So could you define a little bit more what the out of pocket spending would be?
Yes, Madam Chair. What out of pocket spending would include would be things like deductibles, coinsurance, co-pays, those types of services. And we get that information through the data that we're collecting from the health plans as well. And so we have that component of the data. There's also some national sources that some data can come from to verify some of that information that we're collecting.
Thank you very much. Please continue.
So in addition to the snapshot look of where spending currently sits, the Health Economics Program also tracks spending over time, and as a result of the 2008 health reform legislation, we are also tracking projected health care spending and looking at that in comparison to what estimated actual spending will be occurring. So what we have in 2008 is we spend roughly $35.1 billion on health care in Minnesota, and that's projected to grow to roughly $70 billion over the next 10 years. Now, what you will see starting this June of this year is another line that will start to appear on the 2009 estimate. It will either be above or below that gray line, and what that will start to measure is what we're seeing in terms of spending related to what we projected. And in relationship to the 2008 law, what that is measuring is the savings associated with reforms that happened through the 2008 law. And so this will be the first year that we will start to be able to measure that difference between projected and what we are actually seeing in spending as a result of the reforms.
Ms. Don Momlove, I'm wondering in the same chart that you have there, if it's possible to also add the CPI or some measure like that, the inflationary line as well, because you know what we're hearing over and over again is that you have the rate of inflation, you have that going along, but that the healthcare spending is way above that line, and I think one of the things is that you know if general inflation is this percentage, why is healthcare spending? This is an economic question. I'm sure maybe you have an answer for that. Why is that so much above and at such an escalating rate as compared to the inflation line?
Madam Chair, that is normally a slide that we do have in here for time, and I think it's a slide you guys have seen in the past. We didn't include it in there today, but it is a slide that we do regularly report on what the trend is in healthcare spending compared to what we're seeing for GDP and in incomes, inflation, those types of things. And for the last few years, it has been rising much faster than what we're seeing for those other indicators.
Thank you, Dr. Golden.
Madam Chair, that was also a slide that you might have seen in Representative Gottwald's committee. We would be more than happy to get that information to the committee.
Thank you very much, Dr. Golden. We really appreciate having that. And I understand and I appreciate your time sensitivity, but if we could have that extra, that would be great. Thank you. And we have another Representative Hosh.
And Madam Chair, just... piggyback on your comments, I think it would also be important that enrollment growth is considered. As we are an aging state with the baby boomers aging, we know that utilization and cost is correlated to age, and I would suspect that much of that increase isn't just because of the inflationary cost, but also the enrollment growth and of high utilizers.
I think you're exactly right, Representative Hosh, and I don't know if you already have a slide or if it's, now we're getting a slide that's just so big we can't capture it all, but if there's any way you can add some of those questions at all from Representative Hosh, that would be great too.
Yes, Madam Chair, we'll look into that.
Okay, thank you very much. And then we also have Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I wasn't going to stop you, but since we're doing these questions, backing up to the total, the pie chart with the different sources of where the money is spent, the out-of-pocket, I'm also wondering if that includes things like, you know, people buying over-the-counter medicines or going to the massage therapist, those kinds of things they might pay for out-of-pocket, because I think we know there's a big growth in, you know, what we call alternative medicine, and maybe a lot of that is paid for just out of pocket. So are we counting all of that as much as we can?
Ms. Todd Malmlove.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative, yes, we're trying to capture some of that. I was just, in the examples that I was referencing are the larger categories of what out of pocket would be, but those things related to healthcare spending would be in that larger estimate.
Thanks. Thank you, Ms. Todd Malmlove, and Representative Liebling. I think the hard thing for me is how do you define some of those things as health care versus just comforting? And I think they do have some things, but I don't know how you would always define or include them sometimes. And that's a little bit of what I was also thinking of might be in here and was wondering what was more included, because I think I can understand the co-pays, deductibles. When you get some of those other more softer or more indirect things, it's important to make sure that when we're looking at these that we have a good definition. So we, you know, it's pretty easy to do private health insurance, but the out-of-pocket, and especially since it's a fairly large number, you know, a more inclusive definition, you can maybe follow up with that, too, if you would like to wait for another day and get the rest of your slides done.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so also related to healthcare spending, we just went over total healthcare spending, but we also break down spending into particular categories. So here's an example of where we're looking at total cost and spending for just the private market. And so what we're seeing per capita for private spending for at the health plan level and also at the enrollee level. And the important thing to note from this slide is actually related to out-of-pocket spending, where roughly 10 years ago we were at, you know, about 10% of healthcare spending was out-of-pocket by enrollees, and now we are at around about 16% of spending in the private market is for out-of-pocket spending. And to get a sense even more detailed, give a few more examples of looking at the private market in more detail, we also look at spending and premium growth in particular markets. And here's an example for the small group market where we track average premium growth that we're seeing in this market. And the one thing that I wanted to point out here is that you often hear small employers saying, well, my premiums are growing very rapidly and they're growing very high, my costs are getting very high. And what we're seeing in the premium trend is that they roughly have been around 5% or so a year. But what is leading to that is that employers have been changing the types of plans that they have so that they can keep their premiums at a reasonable level. And so as an example of that, one of the things that we've been tracking is what the benefit set looks like that's happening in the small group and the individual market. And what you will see as one example is that the benefit structure has been changing quite a bit. And so you have more and more enrollees in small employer plans that are having higher and higher and higher deductibles. So although their premiums may be not growing as fast, their out-of-pocket cost sharing for deductibles, co-insurance, co-pays is growing. And so that's what we're seeing in that market. So that just gives an example of some of the spending trends that we are tracking. So now to talk about health insurance coverage and give some examples there. This pie chart shows the sources of health insurance coverage for Minnesotans. And what you will see here is that the majority of Minnesotans get their health insurance through the private health insurance market. So roughly 64% of Minnesotans have private health insurance coverage. When you break that down, the majority of them are in self-funded plans as opposed to fully insured plans that represent 25% of the market roughly, and that 25% of plans is the plans that are regulated by the Department of Commerce and by the Department of Health under the jurisdiction of that. Self-funded plans are where the employer is funding the risk for that plan, are not plans that are regulated by state regulatory entities. other sources of coverage that exist in Minnesota is you have roughly 12% of the population is enrolled in Minnesota's public programs, so MinnesotaCare, medical assistance. 14.7% is enrolled in Medicare. You have half of a percent enrolled in MSHA, which is Minnesota's high-risk pool, and 9% of the population being uninsured. And if you look at those trends over time, we have seen some differences in the sources of coverage. First, we'll start off with enrollment in public programs. What you have seen here over time is there's been an increase in public programs, and that increase has come from two different sources. One is increasing enrollment in Medicare as the population ages. There's been more enrollment in that program. We've also seen increasing enrollment in the medical assistance program. MinnesotaCare enrollment has stayed relatively constant over time. However, what we have seen, and I'm sure you have already heard this from the Department of Human Services, is that recently medical assistance enrollment has gone down, and you have seen enrollment in MinnesotaCare growing up. In terms of private coverage, we have seen enrollment in private coverage going down, and most of the decline in private coverage has been that enrollment in fully insured plans. Enrollment in self-funded plans has stayed relatively constant. We have also seen an increase in the uninsured. So the uninsured now sits at 9%. Ten years ago, it was at its very lowest level that we have tracked at 5.4%.
Ms. Tallmamlov, I was wondering, you made a mention that in the more recent numbers that the trends are a little bit different. Does that mean you, I know in this you have, three different years. Do you have 2010? I know where you have to wait to usually finish the year before you can kind of accumulate the data. But are you close, ready, or have some information on some of those areas for 2010?
Madam Chair, what we're seeing for 2010 are just some of the initial numbers that have been coming up from the Department of Human Services, where they are tracking enrollment on a monthly basis. And so we, as you all monitor that, we monitor that as well. And so we're just monitoring those recent trends from those components. The other components that we track do come in at a later period of time, and so we don't we would not have 2010 data for other components of private enrollment, for example.
Okay, thank you very much.
So other trends that, to explain the trends a little bit more that we're seeing in private coverage, this represents the percent of the population enrolled in the private components of coverage split into individual market, the small group market, and the large group market. And so what we see in 2009 is slightly over half of the population enrolled in large employer plans, 7.3% enrolled in small employer plans, and 4.8% enrolled in individual market plans. And enrollment in the individual market has been relatively constant over time. We have seen a decline in group coverage both in the small group market and in the large group market. And relating that to the previous slide, that is generally related to reductions in fully insured, in the fully insured market coverage. So related to what we are seeing in declines in employer-based coverage, we are also tracking why it is that we are seeing declines in employer-based coverage. So this slide has three different components of tracking employer-based coverage. What this looks at is of those employers that offer coverage, what employees are eligible and which of them are taking up. And so the first two bars represent of those employers that are offering coverage, what percent of employees are eligible for that coverage. And so roughly 80% of employees are eligible for coverage where it's offered. Of those that are eligible, the next two bars represents what percentage are taking up that coverage. And we have seen a decline in this percentage. So roughly 10 years ago, you had 85% of the population. If they were eligible for coverage, they were taking it up. That has declined to 78% of the population, if they're eligible, that they are taking up coverage. So we have a decline in take-up. And so the last two bars just represent a multiplication of the first two components. So it's the percent of employees within employers that offer coverage that are actually have coverage through that employer. And so that has declined as well, primarily as the result of declining take-up rates.
Ms. Tallmamlov, I have a question for you. Because when I was looking at this other bar graph, I know that we've also at the same time have changed eligibility, and that would have an effect on some of these shiftings and numbers as well. Do you factor in the increase in eligibility, whether it's Minnesota Care or medical assistance programs, as to an effect that may have on some of these bar graphs as well?
Madam Chair, these slides would not take that into account, as they're just related to the eligibility rules that exist from the employer. And so if the employer offers coverage, if they had been changing their eligibility rules, for example, if the waiting periods were longer, for example, that could reduce the percentage of people that would be eligible. But we have not seen a reduction in eligibility, employer eligibility requirements for coverage. So this just represents what the employers are doing around eligibility.
Okay, well, Ms. Todd-Momlev, is there going to be somewhere where some of those shifting eligibility things, especially in the public assistance program, and some of the cause effect of that, is that going to be maybe covered in another area or another day?
Madam Chair, we do have a slide more towards the end.
Wonderful.
Around the uninsured.
You're so quick.
Around the uninsured that references who may be eligible that's not.
All right, thank you.
And so another slide, just as an example of the types of things that we track, is around actually who is offering coverage. And so the prior slide looked at employers offering coverage and what we're seeing in terms of differences there. This just explains what is actually occurring in the employer-based system and what you're seeing in terms of trends for offering of coverage by employer size. And overall, roughly half of employers are offering employer-based coverage, but that varies greatly depending on the size of the employer. So employers with more than 100 employees, a large majority of them are offering coverage. Once you get below that, especially those below 50 employees, you're looking at roughly 40% of employers that are offering employer-based coverage. So the next few slides provide some other examples of the type of information that we track. And these slides look at, of those people that are getting coverage, which health plans are they getting coverage from? What is the market share of health plans in the market that are offering coverage? And so this represents the fully insured market. So which health plan companies, what are the market shares of health plan companies in Minnesota for fully insured coverage? And as you would expect, the top three in the state are Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota, Health Partners, and Medica. They represent the largest share of enrollment in that market. And we can break that down into smaller chunks as well. You can look at the small group market. The small group market shares, you also have Blue Cross, Blue Shield, Medica, and Health Partners that are comprising the bulk of the small group market. But we do see a shift when you look at the individual market. When you look at the individual market, market shares are primarily concentrated with Blue Cross Blue Shield. They have the bulk of the enrollment in the individual market.
We have a question, I believe. Representative Huntley.
Yeah, on that slide there, Ms. Momlev, this would not include Medicare supplements, right? Just the fully insured?
Madam Chair, Representative Huntley, that's correct. This just includes the individual market, that's excluding those, yes.
Thank you. Representative Huntley?
That's fine.
Good, wonderful. Ms. Todd-Momlev, please continue.
On the next slide, this is another market share slide, but this slide represents what we're seeing in terms of shifts of what types of health plans are out there and where the enrollment exists in those plans. And this shows the trend that we're seeing in enrollment in nonprofit health plans. Minnesota has historically been known as a state where enrollment in private health insurance coverage is in nonprofit carriers. However, we have seen a shift over time where in 2003 we had roughly 80% market share in nonprofit health plans. That's down at around 60% today. And the reason for that is in Minnesota, there's a requirement that the HMOs be nonprofit, but not for other types of insurance companies. There's not that requirement that they be nonprofit. And what we have seen over time is a shift from HMO coverage into commercial health insurance coverage, and in some of those subsidiaries of HMOs that offer coverage in the state. For example, Health Partners has a insurance subsidiary. Medica has a Medica health plan and a Medica insurance company. And so we've been seeing enrollment shift away from HMOs and into those commercial insurance companies, and that has led to the decline in enrollment in nonprofit profit health plans. And you'll see this on the next slide as well, where we are seeing this slide tracks enrollment in HMOs over time. You'll see that from 2003 to 2009. And what you'll see here is that enrollment, public program enrollment in HMO as a share of the population has been relatively constant over time, but we have seen a decline in HMO enrollment for commercial plans that has dropped from roughly 14% down to 6%. And so enrollment is shifting away from HMOs and going more into that commercial health side of the business.
Ms. Todd-Momlove, we have another question here. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I hope you don't mind all these interruptions. It's, you know, I guess it's a good sign that it's very interesting to us. So one question that I have is the definition of an HMO versus commercial insurance. I mean, obviously one's nonprofit and one is a for-profit, but HMOs aren't really doing what we traditionally, you know, thought health maintenance organization meant, that or that they were managing care. And so what's the definition now, or what's the essential difference in what they actually do?
Ms. Todd-Momlove.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, there are some key differences in how they are regulated. So HMOs are regulated through the Department of Health, and commercial insurers are regulated through the Department of Commerce. Well, under the Department of Health, there are some additional regulatory functions that HMOs need to comply with, and I'll just give a couple of those. One is around network adequacy for providers, and so they need to ensure if they are going to offer a health maintenance organization in a plan that may limit providers in that plan, that they must have an adequate network to be able to offer that plan in that geographic area. Another example is that they need to comply with a variety of quality assurance and utilization types of metrics as well, assure that they're providing quality care. So they also have some additional reporting requirements related to those things.
Representative Liebling?
That's fine, thank you.
Okay, wonderful. Representative McDonald has a question for you as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Todd-Momlove, did I pronounce that correctly?
You did.
Question, and I hope you don't mind, I'm going to go back to page 12, or slide 12, and just curious as to regarding the Minnesota healthcare spending and the source funds, in that pie, what will that look like in 2014? What is the forecast if the ACA is indeed implemented in the state of Minnesota?
Get to the right pie.
Ms. Todd-Momlove. Or Dr. Golden, whichever of you would like to.
Madam Chair, Representative McDonald, is this the right pie?
That is correct. Okay. Particularly, I'm looking at the private health insurance at 42.5 and out of pocket at 12.9. Just curious as to how that diagram will look.
Ms. Todd-Momlove.
Madam Chair, Representative McDonald. We are projecting coverage forward in a combined manner, what our total spending will be into the future. We have not projected what differences in coverage levels will be as a result of the ACA, primarily because we are just starting to look at some of those things and what the impact will be on coverage, but it is not something that we have engaged in yet.
Representative McDonald?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you very much.
I'm sorry, I wanted to follow that up. With a question.
Yes.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So you're just starting to look at it, but no numbers at all, any forecast whatsoever? And the reason I ask is because I hear that if this is implemented, that many of our private health insurance companies and agents will be eliminated. And of course, knowing fellow friends and family and those in my district are that, insurance agents, that I'm curious as to now they're 42.5%. So I would really love to, and I'm sure all of us would be important for us to know what that looks like in 2014.
Ms. Todd-Momlove or Dr. Golden, is this something that you anticipate collecting some numbers, but are you ready today for any estimate or opinion on that?
Madam Chair, Representative McDonald, as I was mentioning, we don't have any estimates yet, but it's one of those things that we are looking at incorporating into future projections. At this point, it's just difficult to do that as some of the things are still still yet to be looked at. It's new legislation, and we're trying to figure out what that impact of that would be. So, no, we haven't incorporated that yet, but we are looking at it.
Representative McDonald?
Lastly, any anticipation of a date, or is it too soon to tell that when you'd have your information available?
Madam Chair, Representative McDonald, it's just a little too soon to tell at this point.
Madam Chair, thank you.
Okay, thank you, Representative McDonald. And Representative Todd Momlove, would you, I think we were back. Oh, we have Representative Gutwalt. Did you want to wait till the end, or are you?
Oh, no, thank you, Madam Chair. I thought I'd just comment briefly on Representative McDonald's question. I think there's at least, I realize we don't have any accurate estimates, but there are suggestions that initially this would expand private coverage, that you'd actually have more people buying insurance, which on its surface sounds like a good thing. The question is, long term, what would it do to that pie chart? And I don't think we have good answers for that yet. But at least initially, there's suggestions that the ACA would in fact involve more people in private insurance. But it is a question of how that's done, and so the devil's in the details, as they say. But it's a valid question. But that's kind of what we're hearing on the national. On the national front, are the projections of what will happen under the ACA.
Representative Gutwald, I was wondering as well, and your knowledge of those numbers, are you thinking that the shift to the private would come from the employer, that we would lose on that chart on employer-sponsored and instead go to more private?
Madam Chair, I think it's hard to say exactly what part of the pie will be affected. I think some of the out-of-pocket might be taken up, but you might also have people coming from the other public spending portion of the pie as well. It's hard to say just yet how it's going to impact, but you're going to have private insurance offered in these exchanges, and again, the devil's in the details if this is implemented, how this affects the market long term, but supposedly the projections are more people would buy private insurance initially.
Thank you. Representative Huntley, you have a question.
Madam Chair, just to follow up on Representative Gutwald, and there will be an increase in people on medical assistance because of the adults without kids up to 133% of poverty. We will be covered there at full federal expense. So we don't have to pay any share of that starting in 2014. I'm one, and there's certainly a lot of disagreement about this, but I think that Medicare may go away, and all those people would be covered through insurance in exchange with the government subsidy. So I think that there will be an increase in people in the private insurance market.
Well,
your comment is very what's really up in the air is our employers going to start dropping coverage, and so their employees have to buy it through the exchange. Mm-hmm. And we don't know.
I would understand that, Representative Huntley. I think probably the one thing is when I know we had a good discussion last night about this free and that federal money comes out of the same taxpayer's pocket as the state money does. And so when we're all paying, I understand what you're kind of looking at, that as far as the state government checkbook, you might say, but as far as the taxpayer, who ultimately is the one who pays into both of those, it's still the same pocketbook. Representative Gutwalt, do you want to engage in this as well?
Madam Chair, just briefly, I would agree with Representative Huntley's analysis. The concern there, again, and the devil's in the details, is if you expand Medicaid is a part federal, part state program. And as much as the federal government says it's going to cover it 100%, there are still the implication is if you expand Medicaid states are going to end up having to spend more out of their coffers. And I don't think we've figured out how much we're going to have to come up with or where that's going to come from.
All right. Well, thank you, Ms. Malmova, for instigating a good conversation. Appreciate it very much. We don't want to fall asleep on you. So this shows we're listening and being engaged. So if you'd like to go to your next slide, and I believe we're on, not quite sure. All right.
Madam Chair, and I was I would answer Representative McDonald's question with an example of why it may be too early at this point to estimate the impact, is that there are some state-level decisions that would need to be made that would hamper our ability to be able to estimate at this point. And one example of those would be there is an option under the federal law to for those individuals that are between 133 and 200% of the federal poverty level, that they could go into exchange coverage, as Representative Huntley was describing, or the state could do a basic health plan type of program that is similar to Minnesota Care. And so there are some state-level decisions there that also make it a little difficult to estimate at this point.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Todd-Momlev. Okay. And back to the slides, I guess.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. So a few more examples of the types of information that we track. So just on the prior slide, we were explaining enrollment in HMOs and how that has changed over time. And specifically, I wanted to address one of the questions that has this committee has had related to public program enrollment in HMOs and where the spending for that goes to. And so from the data that we collect, we have information on those enrollees that are enrolled in public programs through the HMOs, where the spending goes. And so of the public program dollar that is going there, you have 31.9% that is spent on hospital care, 17.3% spent on physician services, long-term care at 8.4%. And what I would specify here is that this is just the managed care component of public programs, so would not include the fee-for-service component, which is where many of your long-term care expenditures would be. So this is just the managed care component. You have drugs at 10.6%, other services in there as well, dental, other professional, other spending that includes things like chemical dependency, mental health, those types of services as well. Other things related to HMO information that we track as well. We also track information on net income, and we do this by product line. And net income is essentially the difference that you have between premiums and expenses, and so those expenses being claims and administrative costs, and it also takes into account investment income and taxes. And so it's essentially what your income or loss would be after taxes have been paid. And so on the next slide also reports this information, but reports it as profitability, or essentially as a percent of revenue. And so these next two slides are tied. So what this shows is net income across product lines, and it relies on information that MDH gets from statutory reporting from the HMOs on their product lines, and it requires the health plans to split up information that they have on administrative spending and investments between the different product lines. And so what you'll see here is that that the trend we have is that in some years it will be negative, in some years it will be positive, and that that is just generally what you will see in terms of underwriting cycles that exist for net income. But one of the trends that you'll see is that, especially in 2009, is that the majority of net income for HMOs was coming from public programs in the state. And the primary reason for that, tied to one of the prior slides that we showed you, is that the majority of HMO enrollment in the state is in public programs. It's no longer in commercial coverage, and so it's existing in those public program realms. And so this next slide just as a continuation of the prior slide, just puts that information into a percent of revenue, and so you'll see very similar trends on this slide as well. And the next slide, we break out just in total what are the sources of net income. And so net income generally consists of underwriting gain and loss and investment income. And what you'll also see here is that generally you will go in a pattern of having underwriting gain and loss just because of the result of the underwriting cycle. And you'll also see shifts in investment income just resulting for what is happening with the stock market. And so you will see a trend here. For example, in 2008, there were losses in the stock market, so you have a negative component there. And in 2009, that started to rebound where you had investment income coming back into a component of net income. Another component of what we track is related to health plan reserves for companies, and we track this for HMOs and also separately for Minnesota insurance companies. And what you will see here is the information on the change that you'll see that we have seen in reserves over over a variety of years. And generally, health plans hold reserves for a couple of reasons. One of the reasons is that it helps ensure that health plans have sufficient resources or that they are solvent to account for unanticipated losses, and so they need to have reserves there to adjust for solvency, and also just adjust for when you have delays in cash flows, it accounts for some of that for that delay as well. And so there is in Minnesota and nationally, there is a minimum that exists for what the minimum amount of reserves that health plans must hold to be solvent. And so that is something that it's a standard that's associated with standards that are established by the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. So this is data that we track as well.
Ms. Todd-Momlove, we have a question from Representative Huntley.
It's a comment, Madam Chair.
Comment is...
Just historically, in the mid-80s, a lot of HMOs moved into rural Minnesota, and they weren't prepared for what happened to them, and a lot of them went bankrupt because they did not have reserves. So that's part of the reason that we have a reserve requirement, because people pay their premiums, and suddenly the company's broke, and what do they do?
Yeah, the understanding, Representative Huntley, would be that they would have enough money to cover what you paid for in those insurance, and those reserves are very important. I think it also was had to be pretty difficult for them when they went through the, a lot of them invest this to help augment the premiums. It had to be very difficult in 2008 to see the tremendous risk that they had in those reserves, and to all of us as well. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And before we move off of this topic of the HMOs, you know, it occurs to me that we've got a lot of good data here about the HMOs and their economics. And we've been hearing a lot in this committee, or maybe it's in the Reform Committee, about how overburdened the HMOs are, or the managed care organizations generally. They say they file all kinds of reports, and apparently a lot of them go to you so that you can figure this out. And, you know, I assume that that's how you're getting a lot of this data, is from reports that they're required to file and are filing. And, and maybe you're not prepared to answer this question today, but I'm just wondering what your response would be to the general complaint that they're being required to file too much, and that it's, and the general concern that maybe they're being asked to file stuff and generate data that isn't being used anywhere. And, you know, maybe if you don't want to answer that now, it's fine, but I don't know if you're even the right person to ask about that.
Dr. Golden?
Madam Chair and Representative Liebling, you know, I think that most of the data collection, whether it would be the Department of Health, Human Services, or the federal government, is usually in response to policymakers that are looking for particular answers, or to make sure that they're addressing concerns that might be arising, whether it's in the marketplace or with your constituents. And I think that probably the you know, it never hurts to take a look at what we're collecting and making sure that what we're collecting today is the information we need for the challenges that we're facing today. Certainly in the governor's budget, one of the things that we have done with the health economics program is recommended the elimination of three reports because we don't think that they are useful for what you're doing. And so to that end, I don't really know if they're doing too much or too little or the right amount, but I do think that it is fair to look at those issues on a routine basis, because we want to collect information that's helpful to you, not information for information's sake.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Golden and Representative Liebling. Representative Gutwalt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just add to that briefly. I think Representative Liebling is making a good point. There's been a lot of questioning of it, and I think what we're finding out so far is an awful lot of data is being exchanged, and And the question, I think, and kind of underscoring Dr. Golden's comments, is it the data we need, and is it useful? Do we have systems in the state to mine the data that we have for the information we need to begin looking at things in a reform-minded way? You know, are there ways to model these things differently so we can identify whether we can, in fact, drive savings and improvements in quality and access and all those sorts of things? So there have been some rather interesting conversations this session already, and I look forward to those continuing between the health plans and the departments.
Representative Gutwalt, Dr. Golden.
Madam Chair, and to, I think, Representative Gutwalt's point, you know, one of the things that we had in the data that we collect is the encounter data. You know, one of the interesting things about that is there was an attempt by the department to work with the health plans in the early 90s to collect that data. And as we had some work groups, one of the things that we concluded that time around is that we weren't ready to collect it. It wasn't standard enough at their organizations. It wasn't standard enough for us to be able to use it in a meaningful way. And about 14, 16 years later, that has changed. And there is now, I think, 8 states that already have this as a resource. And so I think one of the questions is, how can we use new capacity, new data sources like that, to alleviate some of the previous reports which were compensating for the inability to get that? And I think that's an ongoing activity that we're happy to engage in.
Thank you, Dr. Golden. And you'd be interested to know I do have a bill coming forward touching on that area of reports, in part for that reason. We've accumulated some that are either in a standard or requirements or something, and just being able to take another fresh look at that, because when times are tight, it's especially important that we not waste time, either yours or those preparing them. And so we'll continue to work with you on gathering that information. Representative Huntley.
Again, a comment, Madam Chair, and I think this is an area that we really ought to look at, because we require most of them. We're the ones that say you got to make this report, and you know, we're not going to save a lot of money if we get rid of a few reports, let's face it. But it might be certainly worth doing. I know we mandated that the Department of Human Services give us a report on the public programs enrollees and what was happening, and that came out in January for the first year, and as far as I'm concerned, it had no useful information in it for me. And, you know, is there a better way to do the report, or should we just not do it?
I think those are excellent questions, Representative Huntley, and I'll look forward to working with you on that subject and the department. And, you know, we hardly know sometimes really what the cost of those reports are. And some are more huge, and I think the cost-benefit value to them, I think there are some that are a lot of effort, but golden as far as the value that they are to us and others. And I think when you have a multitude of reports, it hinders you from using the data that really is important, and that's almost, it's worth that. So we'll look forward to that. Dr. Golden or Ms. Todd-Mamla, do you have some more slides, don't you?
Yes, Madam Chair.
All right.
So we've just been talking about coverage primarily in the private market and some information about health plans that are covering public program enrollees. So next we wanted to talk about those individuals that don't have coverage, so talking about the uninsured. One of the data sources that Dr. Golden mentioned earlier was that we collect a health insurance survey every other year. We do that in conjunction with the University of Minnesota, and that survey allows us to find out information on the uninsured. And so we have been doing that survey for a while, and so we have a long-term trend of what percentage of the population is uninsured. So in 2009, we had 9% of the population that was uninsured. This is the highest percentage of uninsured that we have tracked since we have started doing this survey. And we also collect information on what components, what the uninsured is comprised of. And this is one slide that shows you of the uninsured, there's roughly 478,000 of the uninsured in 2009, and 395,000 of those were adults, 83,000 of them were kids. We also track uninsurance rates separately for age and for a variety of different demographic factors. This slide looks at uninsurance rates by age, and what you will see on this slide is that the age groups that are most likely to be uninsured, and particularly more so in 2009, are those age groups, the young adults, the 18 to 24s, and adults ages 25 to 34 as well.
Ms. Todd-Momlove, wouldn't it be logical to think, though, that at, you know, there's the difference between those numbers, but also that the economy, its general circumstance, is probably partly responsible for this change as well?
Madam Chair, that is likely the case. When you do enter an economic recession and there are layoffs that occur, for example, at companies, it generally will tend to be those workers that are younger or that are there earlier, and so that does make some sense with the economy that we've seen.
And Ms. Todd-Momlove, is this also a situation where this is temporary? In other words, sometimes you might have a pool of people and they're in between for a while. They may not be the entire year, but it might be part of a year, but they would contribute to the raw number. Ms. Todd.
Madam Chair, one of the slides that we don't have up here, but information that we do have and we can follow up with the committee, is that we have done analysis on the length of time that people are uninsured, and there are particular components of the population that are uninsured for a very long period of time. They're uninsured for a year or more, and then there are other components that are uninsured for a short period of time, and so we can provide that to the committee to provide some information on what the length and
I would appreciate that, Ms. Todd-Momlove, to all of us. Representative Gutwalter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bar chart is rather illustrative, though, for purposes of health care discussions. If you look at where the most growth is and where the largest numbers of people who don't have insurance are, it's the young, healthy people typically coming off of their parents' coverage and deciding, frankly, that, you know, when I was that age, I felt that was kind of indestructible, too. And so there's that factor in there. I don't argue that there aren't people between 18 and 34 who aren't in need of health care of any variety. But that is a dynamic of that group of people. And if you look nationally, this is a group that traditionally has fairly high levels of uninsurance because they don't feel they need it, frankly. They're also a healthier group, and they're a group that we'd like to get into insurance more because it tends to help moderate rates and add some healthy lives to the pools in insurance. So it's interesting to illustrate the point, but then also that's kind of a challenge for us, too. You know, how do we get those people involved?
Thank you. And we have another one, Representative McDonald, and then Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to rebound on Representative Gottwald's discussion about that impenetrables, as they call it, I certainly was not one of them. I'd rather have the extra money when I was that age to spend on my Chevy Nova at the time, but it shows my age. Just curious, Ms. Todd-Malfoff. Maloff, I'm sorry, I butchered that. What in that age group, 18 to 34, what is the cost if something major medical happens to that group of folks? Of course, they're uninsured, so we end up paying for those if they break a leg or if they get cancer or something catastrophic. Is there any data collected in Minnesota, not nationwide, what it costs us taxpayers to not insure them, obviously, but to ensure that they get good medical care in those tough, healthy ages?
Ms. Todd-Momlove.
Madam Chair, Representative McDonald, we do have some slides at the end that do talk about uncompensated care, and so we can address
Ms.
that.
Ms. Todd-Momlove, you are just so good at anticipating these things. I don't know. You did a wonderful job. We do have Representative Liebling and then Representative Murphy.
Okay. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative McDonald, you know, NOVA means no va, which in Spanish means it doesn't go.
That's why.
Just so you know, that they sold that in Latin America, they had to change the name.
That's great.
So anyway, I think the case is being made here between Representative Gottwald and Representative McDonald, kind of the case for the Affordable Care Act's provision about covering people up to age 26, because that is exactly one of the issues. You need to spread the risk, get that healthy. That's exactly the kind of group where you want insurance, because the likelihood of an expensive event is lower, but when you've got one, you've really got one. And so rather than having that be on all of us through uncompensated care, you want to make sure those people are covered by your insurance. So there again, you know, we talk about this individual mandate, which many of us hate, and I have to say, I really don't like that idea either, so I share that with many of you. But the idea behind that is you get these people into the pool so that even though they may feel invincible, they have to take responsibility for their own coverage. So there is a real logic behind that, and you're exactly getting to the logic that is in the Affordable Care Act. So I just wanted to point that out.
Thank you, Representative Liebling, although I would suspect that the issue is not including them in that regard in some way, but I think it's the methodology that is objected to. Representative McDonald.
Madam Chair, I think that you stated that well. You articulated that very well, and yes, that is the conundrum. However, at that age, I'm sure you can agree with me that you would hope that the government wouldn't force you to spend your dollars on something you didn't want to. So there's where we have a difference, a little bit of opinion on that.
Well, members, we do have some wonderful slides waiting for us, and Representative Murphy, let's give you this question and let our Todd Malmla at least get through, because we've asked about this data.
Thank you, Representative Madam Chair, Murphy. And, you know, just to add to the pool and a story, there's a young couple that came to visit me on the day that the folks with epilepsy were here. They are both college graduates. The young woman has epilepsy, diagnosed as a young adult. They would like to get married, but if she gets married, she goes off her parents' coverage, which she can stay on right now until she's 26. And because she has a pre-existing condition and she needs treatment, she can't go without coverage and can't get it in the private marketplace that is, you know, got problems. You know, they're not looking to attract people to them that are sick. So there, yesterday when we were talking, there are gaps in the system that we can fix if we are willing to stretch together the private and the public marketplace, right? And if we're willing to recognize that people are falling through the cracks because no one wants to take hold of and be responsible for the people who are sick. That's the challenge before us. That's a real example from Minnesota, a young couple who wants to get married and they can't get married because of her pre-existing condition.
Thank you, Representative Murphy, and I think we could probably have another hour or two discussion that you might have stimulated, but I would suspect that we need to, Ms. Todd Malmlove, would you go ahead and just complete your slides, and let's see if we can get this done in the next couple minutes.
Yes, Madam Chair. So just a couple other examples of information on uninsurance rates. So we also track uninsurance rates by income level, and so just one thing to point out from this slide is that we have seen an increase in uninsurance rates for those at a couple of different levels. One for those between 100 and 200% of the federal poverty level, and an increase for those between 300 and 400% of the poverty level. But in general, the highest uninsurance rates are for those that are at the lower income levels of the scale. We also track uninsurance rates by race ethnicity, and these also vary substantially as well, where you have those populations, those African American, American Indian, and Hispanic Latino populations having much higher uninsurance rates than the population as a whole. Madam Chair, one of the questions that you were asking about earlier is related to potential eligibility for public programs, and this slide has a few different bars that address that particular issue. So if you look at the uninsured, we categorize them as to what kind of coverage they are eligible for, but they're not taking up. And so the first two bars represent the percent of the uninsured that work for an employer that offers coverage at all. So the employer offers coverage to their employees. The second two bars, which represent 2007 and 2009, represent the percent of the uninsured that are actually eligible for coverage that's offered through their employer. So they're eligible, but they're not taking up the coverage that's offered. So that's roughly 17% of the uninsured are not taking up employer-based coverage. The next two bars represent the percent of the uninsured that are potentially eligible for a public program, so eligible for Minnesota Care or medical assistance. And that's slightly over half of the uninsured are currently eligible for public programs, but they are not enrolling in that coverage. And then the next two bars represent the share of the population that is just not eligible at all for employer-based coverage or for coverage through a public program. So that covers some examples of information that we are tracking through our survey on the uninsured. The next few slides I'm just going to go over very quickly. Again, just a few examples of the information that we track on healthcare services and utilization. The first few slides are related to uncompensated care. So the question of if you're uninsured, where are these individuals getting care and how much is that costing? And so what uncompensated care is it's a combination.
Ms. Malmlove, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we literally are at the time of our committee, and so I'm paid to do it because it's fascinating, but you got about 60 seconds to wrap it up.
Okay, so essentially what you're seeing here is uncompensated care. It's bad debt and charity care together. And what we've seen is it has been increasing over time, over the past few years, but it represents roughly 2% of hospital operating expenses. We've seen it a little bit higher in rural areas as of recent years. But when you look at uncompensated care in total, most of the uncompensated care is occurring in your large urban areas, and so you're getting that at Hennepin County Medical Center, Regents Hospital down in Olmsted, those types of places. And the last slide that's here is just a combination of a variety of different indicators that we have on utilization and financial information for hospitals. And what this slide is showing is that particularly over the last year during the economic recession, we have seen a decline in utilization at hospitals. So days, acute care admissions, average length of stay, also reduction in FTEs that are at those hospitals. But generally the margins, the operating margins for hospitals have stayed relatively similar, but we have seen some declines in utilization. So that covers some of the examples that we
have. Thank you very much, Ms. Todd-Momla. I know that was a quick conclusion, and yet we have the data to look at. And Dr. Golden and Ms. Todd-Momla, thank you for coming today. With members, Representative Huntley.
Well, I would like to thank them for their presentation. It's always good, and we must have made them as happy as they can be because we use their data to fight with each other.
With that last word, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.